Thank you, Debbie, and welcome to LCI. It's a privilege to be with you. And I just want to say, I give God thanks for every one of you and for all that you do for the purposes of Christ, for the United Methodist Church. I appreciate you taking some time to set it aside to develop your own skills, to bring home some new ideas, to just think differently about the challenges before us. So thank you for your participation in this. And of course, our thanks to Shane and the entire staff of Christ Church for just hosting a wonderful event. This has been a blessing, and so thanks to all of you and our musicians and worship leaders especially. So navigating change is the general theme, and it's rather interesting to gather together a bunch of Methodists to talk about navigating change and act like this is a foreign term. And you look at our roots, and you look at the language that we so associate with Wesley, and it's words like discipline, general rules, right? It's all these kind of restraining type language about general rules, discipline. The very word Methodist, you know, implies that you've got to have a single method of kind of doing things, and yet this disguises who Wesley really is. This person of remarkable innovation and experimentation. That the whole reason that this movement took life and started reaching people is because he just kept kind of overstepping the rules. So lay preachers, preaching houses, the creating of classes and bands and societies and the use of circuit riders and the crossing of parish lines and his willing to kind of work and learn with from anybody, the Moravians, the Whitfield, George Whitfield, or you know, work with the Countess of Huntingdon's connection. And I mean, it finds its highest expression in his ordaining and sending people to America. So one way to look at Methodism is this restraint, Methodism, rules, discipline. And the other way is look at this just huge experiment in doing whatever it takes to reach people with the good news that God has met our highest hopes and deepest needs in Jesus Christ. And so we've got to reclaim that kind of spirit of exploration, experimentation, innovation, because that's as much a Wesleyan part of our roots as is our Methodism. Let's see, can I advance this or not? Is there something I need to?
There you go.
There we go. So in visiting with Shane about what topics to kind of cover here, I'm going to take some ideas out of the recent book, Just Say Yes, Unleashing People for Ministry. And this book has a very basic theme, and that's that there are 1,000 ways in which we say no to people and restrain ministry. People say no to other people. Older folks say no to younger folks. Traditional worshipers say no to contemporary worshipers. It goes on and on. Those who host, you know, chair, pastors say no to laity. Laity say no to pastors. And we spend an extraordinary amount of time restraining people from ministry. And the same is true in our systems. So many of our systems are set up to slow down innovation and make sure everybody has a say in it so that everything has to go through hundreds of steps in order to get something done rather than just saying yes. And so the book Just Say Yes is based on the premise that growing churches say yes to things that declining churches say no to. That if you just look at the pattern of growing churches, they figured out how to say yes to things that other churches have said, no, that's impossible, can't be done here, here's why, and so forth. And that subtitle, Unleashing People for Ministry, I thought about all kinds of other titles, subtitles for this about setting people free, the permission-giving church, something like that. But I like this notion of unleashing, because unleashing means not only granting freedom, but there's a second definition of unleashing. And that's like when a medical breakthrough unleashes a whole new set of cures. In other words, it's just all of a sudden a burst of new energy of creativity that takes place. And I've seen this happen in churches, and my hope is that with some reflection on this and some working through this, we can become more aware of the systems that restrain us and the systems that set us free. Now, I started, became aware, I was an early learner in this notion of how we say no. I graduated from seminary when I was 26 years old. I just served a year in the British Methodist Conference and a year of internship and graduated from seminary, and I was assigned to this church that there was this just high potential area, but it had just kind of fallen into this pattern of decline that was reflected in virtually everything that it did, and it was controlled, led mostly by older folks who had a great deal of experience in the church. And some of the things were just obvious to a newcomer to a church. For instance, I saw just how completely dilapidated and run down the buildings were. So every place you entered, they were just chipping paint, and nobody in the congregation would have ever allowed their church, their homes to fall into that level of disrepair. But everything was uninviting and just hadn't been kept up, and there were, you know, warped boards, and there were and the lawn of and the landscaping, it had just been dried up in the South Texas desert, and it was just mostly dirt. So this place was one of the most unappealing places to approach that you could imagine. And yet this was a working class congregation full of, it had a few teachers and a lawyer or two, but for the most part, these were mechanics and truck drivers and construction workers and a whole range of folks who were used to doing things themselves. And I remember coming and looking around and thinking, boy, you know, I wouldn't want my kid in this building here, the way it looks now. This just needs at least a paint job. So, of course, you know, knowing how everything works in the United Methodist Church, I go to the trustees and say, you know, hey, what about us repainting this, that, and the other? Well, first of all, it's not in the budget. Second, that's the Building and Grounds Committee's responsibility. You need to visit with them. And Mrs. So-and-so is in charge of the Building and Grounds Committee. Okay. I go to Mrs. So-and-so and say, what about painting this up? Well, the Building and Grounds Committee, their work was to have 2 days each year where they cleaned out this storage area in the church. And they take everything out, throw away old stuff, and then put it back in. But they didn't do painting and the like. So I go back to the trustees, and they say, well, you know, we'd have to get 3 bids, and this, that, and the other. And finally, I just said, so how would you handle this if this were your own garage, if this was your own house? Well, I'd just paint it. Well, I mean, you'd paint it yourself? Yeah. How would you handle it? Well, we'd just paint it. Okay. Well, what if we just painted this? And it's like this light bulb goes off, and then the cost thing comes back that says, well, there would be no labor cost. So it's like, you know, if each of us brings a gallon of paint, we've got this done, right? And they said, oh, but think of, you know, it's going to have to go by the board, the administrative council, and all this, because we're going to have to talk about colors and stuff. Well, what if we just painted it the same color it is so that no one could argue about our choice of colors? And so what we did is we hatched this plan to just, and no secrets about it or anything, but let's just meet on Saturday, and whoever wants to help out, we're going to spend a day painting. Well, guess what happened? I mean, you know where this goes, right? 5 or 6 people show up. We paint a whole section of the thing. And then we say, wow, that worked out pretty well. What if we did this next month? And so we said we were going to do it next month. 12, 15 people show up. And pretty soon, month after month, we started improving how the appearance of the building was. And it was not any committee vote that ever took us from A to B. It was simply people receiving permission to do what they had the skills and insight and knowledge of what to do. So this, after I was there for several months, there was a woman who started attending our services, a middle-aged woman, and she is actually a longtime member, but she had not been in church for years. And so it's kind of a surprise to see her, and she'd come up and just, she'd attend about once or twice a month. And then one day she sets an appointment to come visit with me, and she says, I'm pretty shy, and I don't like to work with committees. I've had kind of bad experiences with that. But my family, I run a landscaping company. And so I have crews all over town all the time doing homes and businesses and things. And I just look at my church, and this is just a gift I would like to offer. There'd be no cost for it. Our crews would come by once a week, once every 2 weeks, and we'd do what it takes to trim. We'd put in some new bushes. We'd replace that big dead tree right outside the front of your office, and with a living tree, and I'm just thinking, oh my gosh, this is so great. And of course, you know, being fresh out of seminary and knowing how the Methodist Church works, I take this to the Board of Trustees. Board of Trustees, we have to see the plan. You know, how do we know that she's not actually going to charge something and we're going to have to pay? We're going to have some kind of contract. What if one of her workers gets hurt? I mean, there were a thousand objections to this. And I said, and she wants to replace that dead tree that's out front. And there's like, that tree was given as a memorial by the so-and-so family for their son who died, you know. And I said, the tree is dead, you know. And I said, she's willing to replace it. Well, I just can't see us doing that unless we got permission from that family. They're the ones that planted that tree and gave that tree. But the tree is dead. So who do I go talk to? Well, the family moved out of town about 12 years ago. So we finally, after kind of being the buffer between these two forces, this person who was trying to live out their ministry and the restraining influences of the congregation, we finally gave her permission to go forward. And sure enough, things started looking so much better. We replaced the tree. Everything was looking so much better. But it's like those forces just kept coming back. You know, pretty soon it was, why that kind of plant instead of this kind of plant? And so this worked for about a year and a half until she'd received enough negative kind of feedback in response indirectly that she kind of withdrew again. And I always felt like I failed her somehow. You know, it's one of those ones that you just put in your back of your mind that she was taking a step toward the church, offering her best, performing a ministry, and somehow we pushed back, okay? So also in this church, after a few months, we started working really focused on, my wife and I were 26, 27 years old. We started these young adult groups, started inviting people to our home. We started connecting with young couples, especially in the community. And so we'd have these house groups, and we'd study things like mere Christianity and when bad things happen to good people, and your God is too small, and all these kind of just kind of classical. This is before Adam Hamilton and, you know, Schnazy and all those other folks came along, and so we were reaching for real theology, so we were having these groups, and this young woman finally comes to me, who's a part of it, and says, you know, I love it. My husband and I, we still want to belong to this group and everything, but there's another need, and that's for younger women to get together, especially young moms, and we'd like to just be able to meet once a month and talk about what it means to be a mom and a follower of Christ and try to balance work and home and, I mean, all the things that's kind of unique to being a woman in your 20s or 30s at the time, right? And I think, well, this is great, you know, except I forgot to ask the education work area about it. And of course, when they heard, it's like, well, who's going to teach it? Who's going to buy those books? And how do you, you're usually going to let them teach it themselves, you know? And so there was this kind of thing. And then this other dynamic took place. I'm bishop of all United Methodists, and I love them all equally, so don't take anything that I say otherwise. But United Methodist women showed up and said, and this was back in the day, of course, nothing's like this way today, but it was all older, retired women from another generation, and they had so been wanting to have younger women involved in their program. So they said, well, if you're going to meet in your home, why not that be a United Methodist Women's Circle? And this young woman said, well, okay, if that's what it takes. And so they became the United Methodist Women's Circle, which was fine until they received the news. And so therefore, this is the curriculum you must study. And who is your president, and who's your vice president, and who's your secretary, and who's your treasurer? Because those four people are required to attend the monthly UMW meeting. And you could just see, you know, the wilting that was going on. It never occurred to them that they needed to elect a president, a vice president, a secretary, and a treasurer. They just wanted to get together for prayer and fellowship and to study. And so early on in my ministry, in that first year, I learned so much about how the church says no to people. Now, this presentation today, actually, if we had all the time in the world, usually I speak to conferences, and I've got about three sessions of an hour to hour and a half. So we're going to be here about 4.5 hours. Well, no, I'm going to talk real fast, and we're going to skip over a bunch of stuff. I still am not sure if I'm doing this right or where I need to aim it. Maybe I just need to say next slide. There we go. People who say no. So one section of the book is about people who say no to other people. Next slide. And I'm going to move through these pretty quickly here. Go ahead. Ways people say no. One is by saying, no, you can't do that ministry because you're not the pastor. So there are churches and there are church staffs where only the pastor can teach confirmation classes. Only the pastor is the one who visits in the hospital. Or the visit to the hospital doesn't really count if it's not the pastor. That's the way it usually counts. It's like, you know, what? You're just a volunteer. Why are you here praying for me? Where's the pastor, right? That's a limiting factor on all the range of ministries that people could be called to. Next slide. I don't need that, so you can't do that. So you have a group that wants to start a new Bible class of some type, and they take it before the church council or to the education committee or what, a Christian education committee, and all those folks are already a part of groups who don't need this new Bible study, and if you're not careful, they turn it down. This is the way why contemporary worship services, experimental worship services, services in other parts of town and stuff get turned down all the time in our churches. It's because the people who are voting to approve it do not see themselves as the beneficiaries of it. So I don't need this, so you can't do it. Lyle Schaller used to say, when it comes to initiating a new ministry, only count the yes votes. And what he meant by that, it's not an undemocratic kind of thing. It's that if you got 20 people on the church council, and three of them say, I want to start a Bible study, and 17 say, we're not interested, just count the three that say, we want to start a Bible study. Because how many people does it take to have a meaningful Bible study? It can start with three. It can start with two. Let's go on to the next slide. That gets to this next one. Only 5 people signed up. We can't do that ministry because of how few people are interested in it. Well, friends, this isn't rocket science. I mean, how many people does it have? Do you have to have a Bible study that is efficacious, that helps build people up in spirit? I mean, you need at least 50 people, right? If you don't have 50 people, then you should not start a Bible study. Everybody knows that, right? Okay, 15. You need at least 15. A disciple Bible, you need at least 12, right? How many people does it take to have an efficacious Bible study? I mean, 2 people can say, let's get together, you know, for lunch each Thursday, bring a brown bag sandwich, and let's start with Luke and read chapter by chapter and pray for each other and see what we see in the scriptures. And it can be life-changing. But people say no because there's too few people interested. Let's go to the next one. They're not our members anyway. This one just drives me crazy. I've had more. This usually comes into play in some kind of youth ministry initiative, that there's going to be a basketball league and they've asked if they can use our gym, or there's going to be a, you know, Boy Scout, Cub Scout kind of thing. Can they use our facility? And instead of figuring out how can the church engage that group, not just rent the facility, not just lend a key, but actually surround these folks. If you're hosting a basketball team or a softball team or something, how can you How can you throw a party for them and all their parents at the beginning of the season and again at the end of the season? How do you get the, instead of asking that question, so many churches are saying, well, why would we do that? Those aren't our kids. Do I have to say anything else about that, or can we just move on to the next slide? So that's our room. So this always amazes me how a group can meet from 9:45 to 10:45 on Sunday morning in a space, and that somehow means that no other group can use that space for all the other 7 days of the week, right? Because that's our room. And often there's even kind of signs, you know, don't touch anything, don't open this, you know, you got to have the key to the, it's another way of just saying no, of protecting this for our, protecting our own prerogatives. Let's go to the next slide. That will never work here. You went off to that big church event and learned all those things. That might work for that church, but that would never work here. Well, the truth is, that probably in the form that you saw it in that other church, that's true. But somehow it worked in that other church. Because growing churches say yes to things that declining churches say no to. So you may have to adapt it. You may have to change up some components of it. But it can work where you are too. Next one. Analysis paralysis. This is the habit. This is the way a church says no, by having somebody who just constantly plays and replays and replays the need for more information. So how much is it going to cost? Are you sure? How many people are going to come to it? How many people? What if fewer than that come? What if more than that come? Then what's going to happen? And they just go on and on and on. So that each meeting over this topic ends stuck the same way it was before. Ever been to those meetings? Analysis, paralysis. At some point, it's not a lack of information that keeps you from going forward. It's a lack of will and of courage and the ability to make a decision. Next slide. You're too young, or you're too new, or you're too different. I'm amazed at how many churches discount the newer people to the congregation who are able to see things and are much more aware of the needs of the world out there than are the people inside the congregation. But often we can't ask them to help plan this because they've just been here a few months, or they're too young, or they're countercultural in some way. Next slide. You didn't ask me first. Now this is the ultimate control mechanism in churches, and that is the person who sabotages every new idea because they weren't included in planning it. It's a sign of a small family church, you know, that has 25 or fewer members in it. But often we have churches that have 250 members in it that have 5 or 10 people who feel this way, that unless I sign off on it, this can't go forward. And sometimes that person's a pastor, by the way, which we've got to learn. Pastors, if you are the bottleneck, if everything has to go by your desk and be approved by you, you will soon be the bottleneck to growth in your church. At some point, you got to set other people free, lay people, staff people, and so forth. Next one. So these are all those ways by which people say no are built on some faulty assumptions about the very nature of the church itself. And the one is this notion that this is our church. I mean, to whom does the church belong? Here we're not arguing about legal and the trust clause and the trustees of the church. I mean, the question is in the larger picture, to whom does the church belong? It belongs to God through Jesus Christ. We're all guests at this church. And when we have this assumption that it's our church, then we protect it the way we protect our house or our property or instead of figuring out how can this be used and to multiply the ministries of Jesus Christ. Next slide. Another faulty assumption is this one that ideas come from the center. Now, for a minute, I want you to picture that we have this set of concentric circles like a target, right? And in the middle of the smallest circle are the what I call the tribal leaders of the church and the pastor. And these are the folks, and I don't mean that in a negative way. These are the folks that, because of their long standing in the church, their respect in the church, that kind of know everything that's going on. And it's usually the pastor. It's usually two or three or four laity, but not a huge number. It's maybe one or two other staff members. But these folks kind of know just about everything that's going on. And then if you go to the next wider circle, you have those who chair or lead ministries. So this is your chair of trustees, chair of finance, chair of the board, but it's also your music leaders, it's your leader of the youth ministry, it's leader of Sunday school classes, teacher of Bible studies, leader of mission teams, leaders, 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 right? Then your next circle are those who attend those smaller ministries, the people that sing in the choir, sing in the praise band, the people who attend the Bible studies, the people that serve on the mission teams, all of those folks, right? And then the next circle are those who come kind of just to worship, and they're fairly regular at it, but they don't participate in those other things. And then the next larger circle would be those who just casually come to worship. They consider that they belong to the church, but they're just there here and they just attend here and there. The C&E, Christmas and Easter people. And if you just keep going out in these concentric circles, you eventually reach a point where you find this margin at the edge of this community of faith. And it's at that margin that I would say the church fulfills its mission in Jesus Christ. That's where those who belong to this community of faith engage those out in the world who do not belong to this community of faith. And so we fulfill our evangelistic mission, our invitational mission. So we hope this margin is permeable and that people are entering into the life of the church. And it's where we fulfill our mission service and justice ministries, where we make a difference for the purposes of Christ to relieve suffering and to meet the needs of people, right? So this is going to come to bad, you know, as bad, somber news for some of you. I know it's going to break your heart. But what this picture means is where the mission of the church is fulfilled is not in the middle where the meetings are held, right? It's at the margin where the ministries are performed. And so the role of leadership in the church is to constantly draw the attention of the church toward the margin, toward the ministry field, toward the mission field, right? And it's a mistaken idea that all the best ideas of a church happen at meetings in the middle. As if you name these people to a mission committee or a education committee, and often the way that phone call goes is it comes from you or somebody else that says, please serve on this because the Book of Discipline requires it, and we've got to have three men and three women and three younger folks, and it meets only four times a year, and so please, would you please serve on this? And well, you put that group of people in a room and say, now generate ideas for ministry. That's not how it happens, right? It happens at the margins. It happens when somebody who's engaged with the world says, you know, based on what I've experienced in my work life, we could benefit from maybe a divorce recovery group in this church. And so it starts out here, and then it moves to the middle. So the other, let's go to the next one. The other faulty assumption that these no's rest upon is that it's all about us. And so the most important question in any decision is, what do I want? So when we talk about worship styles and it's what kind of music do I prefer? How do I like? Am I more traditional or more? What meets my needs? And that's a faulty assumption for leadership in the church. It's not about what we prefer, right? I remember a congregation where they were at war over the color of the carpet in the sanctuary and which color was it going to be. And the problem was that every time they get together to talk about it, they get about 40% that want, you know, whatever it was, red, and the 40% that want more, you know, green, and then you have these 20% that, you know, that wanted brown or some other, you know, mauve, or I don't know. That was 1980s. So they just kept getting stuck with what each person wanted. And finally, the pastor, in a moment of kind of spiritual insight, said, maybe the question isn't you know, what color should the carpet be? Maybe the question we need to be considering is, who are we making this decision for? And what else do we need to be doing to reach them? In other words, who's not in this church? And how do we develop a worship service that reaches them? I loved whoever it said, who said it. I think it might have been last evening. The person who said that, was it John that said, I like it when I go to church and there's some of the music that I don't, and some of the music is music I don't prefer, because that means our musicians are reaching people different from me. Does that make sense? So let's go to the next slide. So those are ways that that churches say no. Leaders of growing churches say yes to ministries that declining churches say no to. I just want to keep repeating that. Let's go to the next slide. But it's not just people who say no to people. We have some systems that restrain. Next slide. So this is how systems say no, and this death by complexity. You know, the church with 1,000 steps. There are so many churches that are organized to where if you have an idea, you have to take it to this committee, and then you learn that it has financial implications, so you have to take it to that committee. Then you learn that because that would require a change in the budget, you got to take it to the bigger committee, and so it goes. And so many churches are organized so that there are 5 or 6 steps or more that have to be taken, and all of which have to be yes in order for something to go forward. And any one of these can say no, but none of them has the authority on their own to say yes and give freedom for ministry to begin. Does that make sense? And so we've got all kinds of systems in churches that go through all these steps and just wear people out. Now, most of us of my generation, I'm in the upper 50s and grew up, loved the church. This is a church I see its problems. I see its restraints and everything like that. But I'm so committed to it that I still go to all kinds of useless meetings that just frustrate the heck out of me. And so do you. But you know what? Next generation doesn't do that. They have zero tolerance for useless meetings. They simply don't want to participate in that. They want to get ministry done. And so we've got to rethink our systems. Let's go to our next slide. The church that can't decide. Church that just keeps meeting over the same issue time after time after time and can never come to a conclusion that actually leads to action. It's an avoidance mechanism. Next slide. The church with 1,000 rules. Well, gee, that's a great idea, but according to our trustees' policy, we can't do that in this church. We can't do that inside the building. We can't do that. You have to sign this form. You have to do this. You have to do that. And it's amazing how many groups that we could be participating and cooperating with ministry in that we've set up rules and procedures that keep us from being able to cooperate with them. Let's go to the next slide. The report, review, rehash, and redo church. I've just described how most United Methodist meetings go. Instead of it being a learning moment, or instead of it being an action decision, or instead of it being an inspirational kind of time, what it is simply going around the room hearing reports on what has been happening. And what happens is often 2/3 of the people have already heard this report, because the report was first given in the education, Christian Education Committee, and then it was given to the Council on Ministries, now then the Administrative Council, and then if you go to Charge Conference, it's repeated there, and it's simply rehashing, redoing the same thing over and over again. Drives me crazy. Next slide, the Church of Micromanagers. I remember being asked to consult a congregation one time about just why it was so stuck and why it had such talented staff, such good lay people. What was going on? And so I just, in kind of befuddlement one time, said, could I see the minutes from the last few months of the administrative board meetings or administrative council meetings? And they said, sure. And so they pulled out these minutes, and each month, the administrative council was meeting for about 2.5 hours, and recorded in the minutes would be all these discussions about whether such and such a banquet should start at 6 o'clock or 6:30. Whether this fax machine should be bought or that fax machine should be bought. Whether, you know, this computer, the program should be used or that computer. And so infinite detail with all these people brought together to do that. And what was interesting is then when I said, what about the finance committee? What about the trustees? Is there were equally large sets of minutes for each of these every month. So that's the kind of church I was appointed to, both as a 26-year-old, but also later in the church that I served for 16 years. And after the first couple of years in that second church, we got to where we had one administrative council meeting. Had three administrative council meetings a year that lasted 1 hour. And the finance committee met for 1 hour every month, and the trustees only met when it was necessary to actually vote on something or to deal with an issue, which meant they met five or six times a year. And suddenly the church was set free. Now, what did all those people do with their extra time? What they did is we were also at that time shifting into new Bible studies, disciple Bible study, doing mission work. And what we did is shifted the focus from serving on committees to doing ministry. As a matter of fact, if you look at the bulletins from the before I got there to the bulletins about 12 years into that 16 years, on the bulletins before, it would have on the back of the calendar, these were still printed bulletin days, it'd have on the back the church calendar, it would have 11 o'clock service on Sunday morning, 5 p.m. MYF, Wednesday choir rehearsal, and then everything else on the calendar was meetings. Work area meeting, trustees meetings, finance meetings, education meetings, worship meetings. It was just meetings, meetings, meetings. If you compare that to about 12 years later, there were no meetings listed on the calendar. The calendar was a page and a half single-spaced long, and it was all mission opportunities, service opportunities, learning opportunities, Bible studies, support groups, ministries of all types. And now you think about what each of these two bulletins, what these two calendars to communicate to someone who's new to the church. If you're new to the church and you actually are struck, you're touched by the worship services and the hospitality of the people, and you say, this is a place where I think I could grow in faith. You look at this first bulletin, and what it communicates is, if you commit yourself to this church and you grow in grace and the knowledge and love of God, and you're here long enough, one day you'll serve on the board of trustees and maybe even be able to chair it. What do you see if you look at this second bulletin? It's that if you grow in grace and the knowledge and love of God, you're going to be on one of these mission teams. You're going to be in one of these Bible studies, and you may reach a point where you're leading one of these. That's the difference in how we foster these. Next slide. Many congregations require 5 to 7 layers of organizational approval, and each person or committee has the ability to say no, but nobody has the ability to say yes. Next one. Unhealthy expectations that undergird these systems, that everybody has to know everything. Next one. All risk must be avoided. You know what I mean by that? The reason we have these systems is to avoid risk. It isn't the risk of liability. It isn't the risk of overspending. It's the risk of criticism. It's the risk of disappointing someone. It's the risk of making someone mad. And that's why we have to go through all 7 of these committees, is to make sure nobody says, now, you didn't talk to me about it. Or, wait a second, what about my opinion? Let's go to the next one. And unhealthy expectation is leadership means control. Leadership means helping people means setting people free, means helping people fulfill their mission. Let's go to the next one. And it's based on this notion that meetings are where the action is, where the action is really in ministries. So I think what may be coming up next is a video. Is that right? Let's see if that's what comes up next. Oh, why does it matter? because if we don't change these systems, we just become less and less relevant to the culture around us. Young people have no tolerance for this. Second, that people now have such more immediate options. It used to be that if you wanted to, if somebody had an inspiration to, you know, maybe we should help with fresh water in Africa and dig water wells in Africa. Well, it took months to find out how you did that and what you had to connect to that and what the organizations, and you called the conference office and you had people come out and teach you that. Nowadays, you know, in the same meeting that you're at, you can find five options about how your church could support water wells in Africa, right? And so that this, there's an intolerance for this kind of complexity. And then the next slide, the worst of it all is nothing gets done and our ministry just stagnates. Next. So let's watch an example of just say yes. So that's one of a number of videos that are in this little packet that can accompany the, if you wish to use just say yes with your leadership team. Some of them are small rural churches, some of them are urban, suburban churches, some of them are big churches, and then there's about 8 or 10 pastors, including Matt Myoski and others who are videotaped kind of sharing ideas of challenges. Like he has one that's when it's right to say no, which is another part. It's a small section of the book as well. But anybody that wishes to use this material, there are supplemental things that help kind of participant guides or leadership booklets and so forth that are available from Cokesbury, as well as the main book itself. Now let's go to the next slide. And let's turn the corner. This is where, you know, I'm feeling the press of time. The whole book is to get to yes. And so let's move to the next section here. Churches that say yes base that on missional assumptions. They operate with a certain set of assumptions that differentiate them from other churches. And one of those assumptions is that everybody has gifts for ministry. And they just assume that. From the time someone first starts exploring their relationship with the church, their relationship with Christ, they're kind of on alert, looking for what gifts does this person have for ministry? What does this person bring to the body of Christ that help builds up the body of Christ? And so they teach things about fruits of the Spirit and gifts of the Spirit, and they talk about all the time helping identify people, kind of where can they connect up with the ministry. The next missional assumption is that God calls everyone to service and ministry. That we've made a fundamental mistake for so many years of having this word ministry tied to a track toward ordination of some sort, instead of realizing that we all have gifts of ministry, we all have ministries, and that lay people's ministries are the forefront of the ministry of the church, is what people do in their day-to-day lives, what they do in their work lives, what they do in their neighborhoods, what they do throughout the week, and what they do together when they gather to pray and to plan together to make a difference in the lives of others. But God calls everyone to service in ministries, and that ministry should foster spiritual growth and discipleship. So many times we have ministries just because the church down the street is offering that kind of program, or because they become activities. They become just more things that take up people's time rather than things that change people's lives. But every ministry a church offers ought to be built on that assumption that if you are a part of this Bible study, you're a part of this mission team, you're a part of this this project of some sort, that it will help you grow in grace and in the knowledge and love of God. It will deepen your discipleship, and that you will be closer to God somewhere down the road than you are now, sometime in the future than you are now. And by the grace of God, we hope that you're closer now than you were when you first started this journey. And the next one is this assumption that the church's mission is outward focused, that this is not about maintaining an institution. This is not about energies being moved back toward the center of the church. This is about a view of how do we reach out? How do we look at the fact? How do we look at it that the reason your church is located where it is because you have a distinctive mission field that you're called to reach. And you may not even know that mission field very well. It who comes to your church may not even be representative of the mission field where your church is. And then the next slide. The church is a school for love, helping people grow in grace and in the knowledge and love of God. let's go on. Systems that say yes. We've got 5 minutes left here. The goal of rethinking congregational systems is to make them accessible, sensible, and effective in accomplishing multiple ministries. So let's go on. The book explores two or three different examples of churches that have intentionally adopted systems that minimize the structures and governance models, but instead have opportunities by which people can step forward with ideas for ministry and test them in support with the staff and with others of the congregation and receive support and encouragement and refinement about that ministry. And so when somebody has an idea, the first question is, does it align with the mission of the church? Someone may have a great idea that's a fun thing, but it doesn't have anything to do with the mission of your church. It may be good for a school to do, it's good for some other entity in the community to do, but it's not aligned with the mission of your church. Second is, who will do it? In one of the lengthy examples in the book, when you come forward with an idea, they first check the alignment one, then they say, so tell me, who have you already talked with about this? Who's already on board? Or do you have champions for this cause? Because we're not going to take your good idea and just dump it on the church staff to go out and try and recruit a bunch of people to do it. It's more like, this has to be so compelling that you already have a few folks that you know are excited about doing it. And the third is, how will it be funded? Because the other thing that these churches do is they don't say, so we will fund every new idea that you come up with, so just come ask us for money. It's like, if you feel this calling so deeply, and you've gathered some other people that feel this deeply, then chances are you are going to be able to tap into the resources that make this ministry work. We can't just keep putting more and more pressure on the church budget to try to fund all these ministries. And the truth is, most of the ministries that change lives do not cost very much money. They're people driven. So I'm going to close with just a couple of real short examples. And then we're going to have to let go of all the other slides and the other videos that we could be watching, but we're gonna call it closed here. So when I was pastor of the church in McAllen, Texas for 16 years, there was a woman in the congregation who just a lovely spirit, participated in the leadership of the church, had great organizational skills, and her husband developed Alzheimer's. And the church surrounded her with love and care. This was before there were all these centers for Alzheimer's care that there are today. This is 20, 25 years ago. So she had to take care of her husband right up to the last few months of his life when he went into residential care and then he died. And she had been a part of so many Bible studies, so many ministries of the church. And about 6 months after her husband died, she came and she said, Robert, there's just been something on my heart. I so appreciated the support the church gave me when I was dealing with my husband. That was so hard. But nobody understood what it was like to be me. That there's just no way to express it. And I've been thinking about this, and I'd like to start just invite whoever has a relative who's facing Alzheimer's. They can come and they can find support in this group. And she had the organizational skills to do it. I said, who else have you talked to? Same kind of thing that we just went through. Well, so-and-so's interested, so-and-so's interested. We talked about it on the church staff a little bit. We talked about it with a couple of the members and said, you know, maybe to get this kicked off, maybe it'd be helpful to have kind of a professional present for the first few weeks of this, first few meetings of this. I wonder who we could get for that. Well, there was a psychologist, a therapist, family therapist in our congregation who had never been involved in any kind of ministries of the church but was a regular attender. And I says, I wonder if she'd be willing. I wonder how much it would cost to contract with her. Well, guess what? She said, I would love to do that. I will be there, you know, for however long it takes to get this up and going. So we had the organizational thing and the woman who came forward first. We had the professional skills in this other person. Then we had to decide, is this just for our own congregation? We can think of 5-6 people that might be affected by this. Or do we put this out to the wider community? We decided to put it out to the wider community. The first meeting had 30 people in attendance, okay? And these people were desperate. It's just, I just don't know. They were like all talking at the same time. And the therapist led them through. And then over, they met once a month. And the therapist remained with it for about 6 or 8 months until it kind of became its own support group and self-sustaining. But pretty soon they realized that there's too many people. And so they moved to two groups. And then the next request we had was this was in a predominantly Hispanic community. All of my ministries were in predominantly Hispanic communities. We needed in Spanish. So then we had to kind of start over. Who's the therapist that could help get the Spanish one started the same way? And who would coordinate that? So we identified that. And so over this period of years, pretty soon there were 80, 90 people every month in two or three of these groups, English and Spanish, receiving support through that church. How much did that cost the church? Did that idea occur at a committee meeting of our missions committee? We wouldn't even have, if we had to put it somewhere, where would we put it? Is it a missions thing? Is it an outreach thing? Is it a community care ministry? Is it an evangelism? It's all those things, right? It started in the calling of an individual who was embedded in the faith. It aligned with our mission. She knew who to turn to help, and it required almost no financial resources. I could give story after story after story of those ministries. Friends, we got to set people free. We got to look at not how do we control, how do we manage, how do we keep this tight, but how do we set people free? How do we unleash people for ministry? So I'm going to stop. I had another story, but that's for another day. You have to invite me back. Break the rule again. Invite a bishop back a second time. So the book is Just Say Yes, Unleashing People for Ministry. There's a variety of support resources. I'm about to fly from here to Westpath Board of Directors meeting, so I'm not going to be with you in the morning or even really much this evening. Anybody that wants to take the things that I have here, it will keep me from having to take them on the plane. So there's one set of samples right here for whoever pushes to the front first. Again, God bless you. Thank you for all that you do for the purposes of Christ, for the United Methodist Church, and thank you for being a part of this afternoon. It's a blessing to be with you.